Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Leonard Leo, and it's my privilege to welcome you all to the Federalist Society's annual convention. We at the Federalist Society are always excited to organize and host the annual convention here in our nation's capital. These several days when we are together provide so many great opportunities to think about pressing legal and policy questions of our day, and also to draw inspiration and motivation from being with old friends and like-minded conservatives and libertarians who share a passion for limited constitutional government. But this is an especially exciting year because we are using the convention to inaugurate a whole new initiative of the society, which we have called the Article One Project. Many of you are familiar with the role the Federalist Society played in developing theories of authority in relation to the executive and the judicial branches. The prominent national debates about originalism in the case of the courts and the unitary executive in the case of the presidency were byproducts of those very focused efforts. But what about the legislative branch? Well, beginning with today's sessions, we are taking on the task of drawing on originalist principles of fidelity to the Constitution to develop a theory of Congress and the proper nature, function, and limits of its authority. Now, I can't think of a better way to get things started than to have Senator Mike Lee deliver opening remarks this morning. I am sure most of you know the senator's background, and therefore, rather than recite aspects of his biography or his resume, I thought I'd say a few words about the important leadership he provides for our country. And I'd like to do that by relating a personal story that just takes us back a bit earlier this fall. It's a Saturday, I think October 10th, and I'd had the privilege of just arriving in Jerusalem that afternoon, and I was getting ready to attend Mass when a text message arrives from Senator Mike Lee. He likes texting. All it says is, quote, "I didn't see this coming," followed by a link to a New York Times story. Now, a deep sense of foreboding sets in. I reluctantly click on the link, expecting some scandalous diatribe against the senator's latest pushback on the White House. But what I find instead is a wonderful little piece that bears the title, quote, "Wanted, a Tea Party Speaker." And that praises the Senator Mike Lee, and this piece praises Senator Mike Lee as fitting that bill. Had the Koch brothers acquired the New York Times while I was flying to Israel? Could it be that the IRS or the FEC is looking into the New York Times' operations and all the news that's fit to print has been at least temporarily redefined by the management? No, alas, it's a column by Ross Douthat and one worth a read. The column's thesis is essentially that it is time for a House Speaker who cares about public policy and who can secure the trust and cooperation of a wide range of House members. Of the conflict over the speakership, Douthat explains, quote, "Maybe the lesson of those struggles is that the speakership simply isn't a job for a professional deal maker and institutionalist at the moment. Instead, maybe it's a job for a conviction politician, an ideologue in the best way who's also interested in governing." This is a very intriguing commentary about the qualifications and character for service in congressional leadership, and perhaps the Federalist Society's Article I Project should consider the issue. But for now, I would like to take the opportunity to underscore what the piece says about Senator Lee. He has been, quote, "a real policy entrepreneur." He is, quote, "a force that moves conservative policymaking away from donor service and toward genuine reform." He is the kind of politician who might, quote, satisfy some intransigence and also provide some very modest ground for bipartisanship. What underlies these qualities is a man who places a high premium on honesty and on building trust with his colleagues as well as the American people. And ultimately, if Congress is ever going to reclaim the place that the Founding Fathers intended it as the most powerful branch of our government, we will need more politicians with the character and integrity of Senator Mike Lee. Thank you, Senator, for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Leonard. It's great to be with you today. This is an event that I look forward to every single year. In fact, just recently, I was with my staff, with my legislative team, talking through various issues that we had to address. And in the middle of this, I came up with a really great joke. It was a pun. The punchline, it was a pun about the Commerce Clause, the punchline of which was a reference to Hammer v. Dagenhart. And I was so proud of myself. I came up with it, and then I looked around the room, and nothing. I looked at each of the, even the lawyers on my staff, nothing. All I got was a blank stare. And I was really sad. My chief of staff at that moment could see that I was upset that no one was laughing at my Hammer v. Dagenhart joke. At which point, he looked at me and he said, "It's okay, Mike. The Federalist Society Convention is coming up." But to show you how funny this joke was and how witty it was in the moment that I came up with it, I was trying to remember in anticipation for this conference, for today's remarks, trying to remember the joke, and I can't remember it, but it was hilarious. But as my staff will tell you, I look forward to this convention every year, much the same way most children look forward to going to Disneyland. So this is a great opportunity, and I'm honored to be asked to speak here. And this was especially true this year, not only because of the list of speakers and panelists who will be joining us this year, but also because of the important and timely focus of this year's conference, which involves the role of the Congress, which I think is something that's especially important to me and is going to be an increasingly important part of the Federalist Society's mission moving forward, as far as I can see it. Now, this is a topic that I've been thinking a lot about lately, particularly over the last 5 years as I've been serving in the United States Senate. But more fundamentally, I've been thinking about the role of Congress, not just as a senator, but also as a United States citizen, as someone who has a deep and abiding respect for the Constitution and a firm belief that our failure to adhere more faithfully to the Constitution has been a real impediment to our success as a country. Not just our failure to look to the Constitution and to follow it faithfully in the courts, but also, and especially, within the United States Congress. We have been a society that has developed and become the most prosperous nation the world has ever known, in large part because, and precisely to the extent that, we have adhered to the Constitution's restrictions. So, with the time I have with you this morning, I'd like to share a few thoughts with you about how I see the role of Congress evolving, and in particular, how I see the need for movements like the Federalist Society to have an increasing role in shaping how the Constitution operates, how it is followed within the United States Congress. You might have reason to call what we see in Congress today inadequate. You might also have reason to describe our current Congress as a sort of absentee Congress. In fact, criticizing Congress has become now so commonplace that it's almost impossible even to make a good joke about Congress. Unlike Hammer v. Dagenhart, which is the source of constant humor around this country, you almost can't even be funny about Congress because it is so disliked. My friend Ted Cruz likes to point out that there are some other things that are always funny. He likes to begin jokes, in fact, by just saying two words. He gets up and he'll say, Joe Biden. You've just proven him correct. He says, you know, you don't even have to say anything else. You just say Joe Biden and you can get a laugh. When you get up and say Congress, people don't even laugh because the joke is so cliche, Congress is bad. It's like people who say, I hate Mondays. It is so cliche that it's meaningless. It doesn't do anything for you. But I do like to remind myself and others from time to time that Congress is an institution with an approval rating hovering between 9% and 11%. This is not good. I mean, that means that we are less popular in America than Fidel Castro. We are only slightly more popular than the influenza virus, boils, paper cuts, and all of those things are gaining on Congress in popularity. But back to the absentee Congress point. Just about a week or 10 days ago, I received an email that helped underscore this image that I have and that so many other people have reason to have about an absentee Congress. Attached to this particular email was a PDF document containing the Senate's tentative legislative calendar for 2016. From afar, the calendar looks just like a patchwork of days marked as red and as black, about a substantial portion of them are red, and a substantial portion of them are black. The black dates are those that the Senate is expected to be in session, while those in red are the days the Senate is expected to be in recess. When you look closely at each month and then at all 12 months together, you can see that the distribution is almost half and half, almost half red and almost half black. It's just like going to the roulette wheel in Vegas, half red, half black. I counted up the weeks. The Senate is currently scheduled to be in session for approximately 30 weeks in the year 2016. The other 22 weeks, all 22 weeks left, are expected to be in recess. So it's 30 weeks on, 22 weeks off. Now, I do have to say, as a recovering lawyer, once a lawyer, always a lawyer, but this sure beats the billable hour system. I'm sure there are plenty of overworked lawyers here who would look at that calendar and say, wow, that looks really nice. Now, to be fair, not just to myself, but to my colleagues, recess is, as my wife will point out to you, not all it's cracked up to be. It's not like it was in elementary school. The days that are in red, that are recess days, are days when we're constantly campaigning around the country. We're very often having town hall meetings with constituents. We're doing other work, and that's why a lot of members of Congress will call recess, instead of referring to it as recess, they'll call it in-state work period. I don't know why we have to euphemize everything, by the way. It always irritated me in elementary school when we had recess, and then there was a certain year, I don't know, it was maybe 1980-81, something like this. Something about the aftermath of the Carter era caused a lot of teachers to decide they had to rename everything. Show and tell became sharing time, recess became break. I really don't know what distinction any of this has, why that matters, but a lot of senators perhaps were raised during that era, and so they refer to recess as in-state work period. But even this doesn't really capture the true nature of the absentee Congress. The fact that we're 30 weeks on, 22 weeks off under our schedule in 2016 doesn't quite capture it. Looking just at the distribution of red days to black days on the calendar, you would think that we had a part-time Congress, maybe sort of like a part-time legislature envisioned by the founders, when the scope of the government was a mere shadow of what it is today. So don't get me wrong. I believe that if we were truly following our founding document, and if we really were operating in a manner consistent with the enumerated powers doctrine, this is something we could easily do. We could have a part-time legislature, and the country would probably be better off for it as a result. But the problem is, we don't have that kind of government. We have a $4 trillion government. We have an enterprise that's the largest entity on the planet. We spend between 20 and 25% of our GDP every year. And when we're doing this sort of thing, a part-time legislature doesn't necessarily cut it. You know, especially when you consider the fact that even when we're in session, those 30 days when we're in session, are not always super productive. And by that, I don't just mean that we're not always getting things done. It's not always better when Congress is passing laws than it's not passing them. But even when we're in session, very often we're dealing with a legislative week that consists of only three whole days. That's not true every week, but it often is. And so as a result, pressure builds up for legislative action. We come into session, we get a few things done, or we start to move in that direction, and then all of a sudden the whistle blows, people start smelling jet fumes, they run for the airplanes, they go back to their home states, and then the whole thing carries on again the next week. It limits quite severely what we're able to do. It limits quite severely our ability to carry out the mandates that we've received from our respective constituents. So let's say that we make the generous assumption that only half of the 30 black weeks in 2016 will be 3 days long. That would mean that the other half would be full 5-day work weeks. Let's make that generous assumption. But even then, the Senate would be working in Washington a grand total of 120 days per year. That's less than a third of the calendar year. And although it may sound like one, this is not meant to be an advertisement for working in Congress. So the absentee Congress of this sort is exactly the opposite, I think, of what the Founding Fathers had in mind. That's not to say that they wanted or envisioned a full-time Congress, because I don't think they necessarily did, but they certainly envisioned a Congress that would meet as frequently as necessary and do as much work as necessary to keep the country moving. Although the legislatures of the days of the founding generation were part-time, based on historical track record of Republicans, of Republics, and on the particular design of the Constitution, the framers expected that Congress would predominate over the other two branches of government. Summarizing this view in Federalist Number 48, Madison wrote, quote, "The legislative department is everywhere, extending the sphere of its activity and drawing all power into its impetuous vortex," close quote. Today, by contrast, most of us tend to think of an imperial president, and we think of activist judges as perhaps the most aggressive, the most domineering, the most dangerous actors within the federal government. Now, of course, with our current president and with many troubling developments in contemporary jurisprudence, we have good reasons to fear the executive and to fear the judiciary and their ability to abuse our rights as citizens. But the founders clearly expected, in a representative republic like that of the United States, that the legislative branch would pose the greatest threat to liberty. Again, in Federalist 48, Madison warned that it is against the enterprising ambition of this department, meaning the legislative branch, that the people ought to indulge all their jealousy and exhaust all their precautions. So what happened? What is it about Madison's warnings? How did Madison's warnings about the risks of a hyperactive Congress come to seem so quaint, come to seem so misplaced in modern times? The most significant reason, I think, is that for much of the past century, Congress has taken steps. Sometimes those steps are deliberate, and sometimes those steps are perhaps unwitting, to invest in its own irrelevance, to make it so that Congress itself would be less relevant, would be less central to the workings of the federal government. So let's take a look at the legislative branch's two most important powers, There's the power of the purse, and there's the power to enact substantive law. What we see is that Congress, over time, has steadily diminished its own role in both of those activities. With respect to the power of the purse, we're increasingly seeing that federal outlays are consisting more of mandatory spending than of so-called discretionary spending, meaning most of it's automatic. Most of it's just determined by law. Most of it happens without any action or inaction by the Congress. The consequence of inaction, in other words, just keeps things going. Then with respect to the enactment of substantive law, Congress there too has invested in its own irrelevance. Let's look at what happens in our modern regulatory system. I keep two stacks of documents in my office here in Washington. Come by sometime when you get a chance. I've mentioned before I serve Jell-O every Wednesday at 3:30. Other senators have a weekly coffee with the senator. I don't drink coffee, so we have a weekly coffee with the senator. Jell-O is Utah's official state snack. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Marco Rubio frequently ask me, don't you guys do Jell-O shots every Wednesday? And I said, no, that's something else. We don't do that. When you come by my office for Jell-O Wednesday, every Wednesday, the Senate's in session at 3:30, you'll see two stacks of documents in my office. One stack is a few inches tall. It's only a few hundred pages long. It consists of the laws passed by Congress last year. The other stack is 11 feet tall. It's 80,000 pages long, and it consists of last year's Federal Register. For every one page of law that we tend to pass each year, the executive branch tends to promulgate 100 pages of law. And the difference there is that we're elected and they're not. Now, this regulatory system now costs the American economy $2 trillion a year. I remember being aghast when I was in law school when we had a speaker with the Federalist Society come to the school and tell us that the federal regulatory system was costing the American economy a ghastly $300 billion a year. That was only 20 years ago, which means that the cost of complying with federal regulations has now increased roughly sevenfold just in two decades. Now, all of this regulatory action is something that members of Congress are sometimes tempted to describe in a way that makes Congress sound like the victim. Oh, look at these horrible regulators. Look at what they're doing to us. Look at what they're doing to the country. We're so picked on. They shouldn't do this to us. Well, you know what? It's our fault. We created it. Congress created it. It did so, in most cases, rather deliberately. Because as it turns out, it's much more fun. It's much more easy, rather than enacting actual substantive law, to enact broad platitudes, statements like, we shall have clean air. And then instead of defining what clean air actually is and prescribing the actual penalties ourselves, we say, and EPA gets to decide what clean air is, what pollution is, and prescribe the penalties attached to polluting the air. And by the way, EPA also gets to enforce those same laws that they themselves will enact. That way, when people are upset that the EPA has, let's say, set ozone levels at a level below the naturally occurring ambient ozone level in many parts of the country, people come to us and complain, and we say, oh, those barbarians at EPA, how could they do this? Go complain to them. They don't care, of course, because they're not elected. This is a way that Congress acts to make it easier for individual members of Congress to avoid accountability with voters. It makes it easier for members of Congress to attain perpetual reelection, and it's got to stop. But the point is this: Congress itself has sown the seeds for its own irrelevance by turning most of our spending into mandatory spending that requires absolutely no action by Congress, and by also making it so that most of the substantive law that takes effect each year isn't even put in place by Congress, only indirectly by Congress, only through delegations of our power, previous delegations, to executive branch agencies. And so, in light of that, you know, maybe one could argue, in many respects, maybe an absentee Congress isn't such a bad thing. If these are the bad things that we do, maybe we shouldn't be doing that much. After all, public opinion polls consistently find Congress is terribly unpopular. But counterintuitive though it may seem, I believe that much of the public's disdain and disgust with Congress is the result of our passivity and our inactivity, which, as I say, is not accidental. It is not one, it's not a situation in which we're the victim. It is, in many instances, by design. So the stultification that has been produced by emblematic of the Congress has not just produced bad policy outcomes. It has left us with decades-old policies that are outdated and wholly inadequate to meeting today's pressing challenges. In an address to Congress in 1861, Abraham Lincoln said the role of the government is to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. But today, too many of our government policies do quite the opposite. They create obstacles for laudable pursuit. And in many cases, they're old laws that have been propped up by a Congress that's either unable or unwilling to address the needful steps for reform. Now, these things end up affecting America's poor and middle class. They are the things that I think are the biggest single obstacles for the poor getting out of poverty and the middle class expanding in America. Economic opportunity is thwarted by our excessive regulatory state that remains in place specifically because of congressional inaction. So the question becomes, how do we strengthen Congress, strengthen it in the right way so that Congress can right the ship, so that Congress can steer us back in a more constitutional direction, back in a direction in which we respect both the vertical protection of the Constitution that we call federalism and the horizontal protection that we call separation of powers. We need to turn this around and we need reform. Well, I think this reform is coming. And that's why I'm not here simply for a doomsday message here today. I'm here with a message of hope. You see, because we're changing as a society. Advances in technology in recent years have brought massive changes to our economy, to the way that we do business, to the way that we interact with each other in the commercial sphere. Think about simple things like Uber and Airbnb. Through technology, new technology that we now have access to that we didn't have just a few years ago, people now have a platform through which they can overcome older institutions. They can work around older institutions. You know, years ago, if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to call a cab if you didn't have a car. You had to hail a cab, you had to find one. If you couldn't find one, you had to call one. It was a time-consuming process. It was a process that was especially difficult if it was raining. And taxi cabs, believe it or not, are not always clean. And so people came up with this idea. All right, let's connect everyone to a network of cars using a cell phone application called Uber. It allows anyone anywhere to get access to a ride to just about anywhere with a touch of a button. And this kind of disintermediation, this kind of disruptive technology has changed the way people get rides. And it has empowered the consumer in a way that has taken power away from the entrenched establishment business incumbents, namely the taxi cabs. This hasn't put them out of business. In fact, as far as I can tell, they're still doing just fine. But it does worry them because this is empowering people in a way that people weren't empowered before, and in a way that always inured to the benefit of these big established incumbents. We need to bring Uber-level disruption to Congress now. Now, it is coming. It's coming because the American people are demanding it. They're starting to expect it. They're starting to see it through services like Uber and like Airbnb, like HomeAway. All these things empower consumers. You just build a platform, you give people access to something else, and it can make all the difference. The Federalist Society started building a platform like this. Now, cell phones didn't quite exist when the Federalist Society was started. Certainly, there was no such thing as the smartphone. But the Federalist Society offered something different that was empowering to citizens, starting from its earliest days, more than 30 years ago. What the Federalist Society did to bring about this type of disruption was that it created a platform through which people could come together and have an open, honest dialogue about important issues concerning public policy, and particularly issues concerning law and the judiciary. What was different about the Federalist Society was that at these open forum type events that the Federalist Society routinely hosts and has since the beginning, all viewpoints were welcome. It was like we were turning on a light in a dark room, or rather, in a room that was lit only on the left of the room. When you turn on a light that illuminates the entire room, some people consider that a lighting up of the right. This isn't actually what the Federalist Society is. The Federalist Society is an open forum. But the effect it has is to give a benefit to those who are tired of looking only in the left side of the room. And when you do that, something amazing happens. Let's think about what's happened since the advent of the Federalist Society. 30 years ago, it was not common at all in American law schools. It was not common at all for aspiring judicial candidates to say things like the following. When interpreting a statute, we always start with the text. Now, that statement is so unobjectionable, it is so clear, it is so plain today, that it's almost difficult for us to remember what it was like 30 years ago. But this wasn't the case. In fact, judges I've talked to will tell me that they notice a big difference between their judicial colleagues, regardless of where they fit along the ideological spectrum, left or right, judges educated prior to the Federalist Society revolution in the 1980s. Are not as inclined to make comments like that. We look at the text. The text is important. We're here to interpret the text actually enacted by the legislative branch. Those who were educated prior to the Federalist Society revolution just didn't make those observations. And so it's amazing what the Federalist Society has done. It brought about an Uber-type revolution in American legal academia and even within the judicial branch. Whether people realize it or not, even leftist judges out there have been influenced by the Federalist Society and by the platform it's created that has empowered the people. That's why I'm thrilled that the Federalist Society is having this conference and focusing on shining a similar light on Congress, on the left side and on the right, so that both are illuminated at once. Again, likely having the effect of giving a benefit to those on the right who have been left in the dark. This will help. It'll help dramatically. It will help us as we see this kind of disruptive innovation taking place in Congress, when people all of a sudden see that we need a couple of things to happen there. Number one, we need to remove the concentration of power away from the federal government generally, so that not every power is viewed automatically as a power that should be exercised at the federal level. Number two, within the federal government, Congress needs to put on Congress's big boy pants and do Congress's big boy jobs. Number three, within Congress, the power of each individual member needs to be emphasized so that the power isn't just exercised by a few people who rise to the top ranks of power within the House and within the Senate. What this all focuses toward is the need for policy innovation and entrepreneurship in the House and in the Senate. When we have that, we have greater accountability with our constituents. That ultimately produces better public policy, because when each individual member feels empowered to pursue these paths of policy innovation and entrepreneurship, each individual constituent is better represented. And as a result, we end up with a government that operates much more in the manner in which it was intended to operate. We end up with a government that's much more empowering of the people. And when that happens, economic growth can be more robust. When that happens, we tend to help the poor get out of poverty. Because you see, it's my belief that the greatest anti-poverty tool that has ever existed, certainly in this country, consists of conservative reforms. Consists of reforms that are designed to empower free market economies and institutions of civil society. Those things have brought more people out of poverty than anything else ever devised by mankind. And it's those things that will be unlocked as the Federalist Society and others start to shine a bright light, not only on the left side of the wall, but on the right side as well, enabling everyone to come forward and start to move reforms in the direction of constitutionally limited government. I thank you for being here. I thank you for your participation in the Federalist Society, and I look forward to the Federalist Society revolutionizing yet another branch of the federal government. Thank you very much.
We have time for a couple of questions before we turn to the next session. There are mics on the floor and a mic at the podium.
Go ahead. Senator?
Yes.
One of the bars to holding the executive branch accountable has been this issue of standing by the Congress if they pursue litigation. A few months ago in one of the Affordable Care Act lawsuits, a district court judge said that there was such a thing as institutional standing in this case when the president spent money for insurance subsidies that had not been appropriated by the Congress. Do you think there's a future for institutional standing by the Congress against the executive?
Quite possibly, yes. I think Congress should have institutional standing in cases like that one. I think as a policy matter, it makes sense. And from the standpoint of Article III justiciability, I think it's very defensible. My feelings on the matter can be described as slightly mixed, however, not because I don't think we do or should have such standing, simply because I worry a little bit about Congress using the ability to challenge the executive branch in court as a crutch. I don't want Congress ever to get to the point that it views that as the one-size-fits-all response to an overreaching executive. I think we've got to get more aggressive about how we use the power of the purse and withhold funds when the executive branch misbehaves. There's something slightly unseemly about a coordinate branch of government saying to the executive, hey, we're really mad. You just abused your power and took away ours. You know what we're going to do? We're going to sue you. And we're going to go to another branch of government and make them work it out. Sometimes that's the only option, but I don't ever want Congress to view that as the only option.
Good morning.
Morning.
The agencies that have been created by Congress have, I think, taken a century to morph. And most of them, I find now, really create such impactful fear over the companies and people that they come to, that only the most egregious crawl up to congressional attention. How does Congress keep in touch truly with the real behavior of all these agencies that they've come to today? I find that as I've gone through Congress, I find most people are cut off from the reality of it because so few people come up and will tell you, unless they're just house on fire.
It doesn't. And that's the problem. I mean, it doesn't because it can't, because there are too many of them who are doing too many things. You know, I've long believed that one of the best things we could do to roll back the excesses of the modern regulatory system is to adopt something called the RAINS Act. Thank you. I talk about this at length in my new book, a book that I came out with a few months ago called Our Lost Constitution. It is a beautiful book, by the way, and if you read it,
it is actually.
It will reverse hair loss, cures a whole host of ailments. All 12 people who have read it have described it as really good. But in my book, Our Lost Constitution, I talk a lot about the RAINS Act and the fact that we need to reform the regulatory system. We need to make it so that there is no new major rule that comes out binding on the American people that can take effect without both houses of Congress acting to affirmatively enact it into law. The interesting thing is, and this goes back to your question, one of the big complaints about the RAINS Act, one of the reasons why it has been stalled so far, even though it's been passed by the House every year for the last 4 years in a row, it's never made it past the Senate. In the Senate, a lot of people say, well, that would require Congress to take too many votes. Congress couldn't possibly keep up with it. Well, if that's the case, first of all, that isn't true. Secondly, to the extent that's the case, we've got a really, really big problem if we have so many laws binding on the American people that the people's own elected representatives can't keep up with it. And that gets back to your point. It simply can't. There are too many agencies issuing too many legally binding regulations. Congress can't possibly keep up with them, and that's one of the problems. The size itself is the problem.
We're going to have to move. Yeah. Senator, thank you very much for joining us and hearkening back to your Disneyland analogy. Thank you for joining the Federalist Society, the most original place on earth. We'll bring our other panelists up now, and we thank you all for coming. And Senator, thank you very much for taking time for being here with us.